Who's going to hurt me? Especially on Christmas Eve, when I'm making plum pudding, a secret recipe handed down through my family. No one's going to hurt me making plum pudding, are they? Christmas wouldn't be Christmas without my plum pudding. I'm Eddie Webb.
I'm Chris Bybee.
And today we talk about the Eighth Doctor's audio adventures with Chimes of Midnight here on Genreless. Is it controversial to say that that Big Finish version of the Eighth Doctor's theme is one of my favorite versions of the theme?
In this space, no, it's not. It is
Okay.
good.
I won't say it's the absolute best, but that kind of the thump at the beginning, it just, oh, I really love how I did that.
Do you realize you're challenging me, and our listeners now expect me to ask you what is your preferred preference of all the different opening things?
I
But
mean,
if you're not comfortable doing that so far on the spot, you don't have to now, but I will ask you the first time next time we do
well, no, I mean, I could say off the top of my head, like for nostalgia purposes, I still have a soft spot for the weird 80s Seventh Doctor version, because it's so fucking 80s. But in terms of just actual music, I really think the 10th Doctor theme was probably one of the best ones.
Nice.
But
So,
anyway.
Eddie, why are we doing audio adventures? There's nothing visual here for our listeners to see.
Well, luckily, we're not just a visual podcast. In fact, we're literally not a visual podcast. We're an audio podcast. But no, we're doing this for a couple of reasons. One is that we just glossed over the Eighth Doctor, and he was kind of canon for a while, and then he was backdoor canon. Now he's officially, explicitly canon, thanks to Power of the Doctor. So we definitely want to talk about it. And also, McGann's Doctor is great, but almost entirely his greatness comes from his audio work. He has been, weirdly, one of the longest running Doctors. And we'll get into that in a minute, because he's still doing new Eighth Doctor stuff today. But all that comes from a company called Big Finish, which is the other thing we kind of glossed over in our last episode. So, how do you want to do this? Do you want me to talk about Big Finish in general? Let me do the history of Big Finish. How would you?
Oh yeah. Because people know if they listened to the last one that it came about, and
Oh yeah.
then we said they got popular, and then we moved on.
So, Big Finish is kind of one of the big success stories of the Wilderness Years. Hilariously, they were not entirely formed of the Wilderness Years, but slightly before. There was a fan company that made audio dramas called Audio Visuals. And they were the kind of fan thing where they would record an audio drama and edit it, sell cassettes of those episodes at conventions in very limited quantities to other
Hey, Eddie,
fans.
what's a cassette?
Okay, I'm not even going there. Google it, youngsters. But they would sell these at conventions at just as fan, and they were unlicensed, completely unlicensed. But they were popular, and they did this from 85 to 91. Around 91, this was right when Virgin was getting started. So the BBC was paying a little more attention to licensing because they're actually doing it now. And so they kind of broke up. Also, rumors come about that they were just kind of getting a little bored with the format. The technology was in between where like they could do it completely analog on cassettes, but computers weren't quite up there yet. So I think there's a lot of reasons, but they just stopped making stuff in 91. Some of the people involved with audiovisuals went off to BBV. We don't talk about them, but most of the rest went and formed Big Finish in 1996. And their plan was to try to do something a bit like other Wilderness Years companies doing, which is that let's make not quite Doctor Who stuff. But their plan was always to try to eventually get a license from BBC to do Doctor Who. So it was not, we're doing this because we think it's fun. It's the, no, this is, we're not, it's not a business venture, and we're actually going to make a plan. So the plan was they reached out to Paul Cornell and started adapting Bernice Summerfield novels. And a couple of them were the novels that were written entirely for Benny. A couple of them were old New Adventures novels that were rewritten to take out the Doctor and relevant materials and put Benny into that role instead. So they did this for a year, and then after they made the first few, they actually sent them to BBC and said, here's the quality of stuff we can make. Here are the kind of actors that are signing on board and the writers signing on board that have worked in Doctor Who before. We would like to have the official audio license for Doctor Who. Now, if you remember, we skipped over pretty briefly, but there was an audio drama around the mid-90s that was on BBC, which involved Pertwee. So the BBC were kind of still exploring doing their own official audio dramas. But frankly, that one didn't do all that great. And this was after the movie had failed. And so rebooting it in audio drama wasn't quite what they were interested in, as we find out what actually happened is they were trying to slowly make moves towards potentially doing some kind of animated prospect, which we got to Scream with Shelka. And also, completely digressing, but also simultaneously, what Big Finish didn't realize is that they're also in negotiations with a Canadian animation company who are in the process of trying to make a Doctor Who animated cartoon, Nivala, but that actually fell apart and never actually went anywhere, sadly. But the concept art is both amazing and terrible.
Didn't even mention it on purpose last time.
Right. Well, it actually happened, so it's fair. But so what they got was they got a non-exclusive license in 1999. And so that started what is now retroactively known as the Monthly Adventures, because they put out one Doctor Who audio drama every month.
What year did they get that license?
1999.
Thank you.
So, and then the premise was that a living Doctor Who actor, so they had the 5th, 6th, and 7th Doctors on board. They write an audio drama for them, and it was structured on two cassettes, although now also they're primarily moving to DVDs. And the cassettes fall away after like the first few months. Sorry, CDs, not DVDs. And CDs are compact discs. Where you put them into your computer, your CD player, and plays audio drama.
But Eddie, what if I don't have a computer or anything like that to put it in? What if I've just got a beatbox, a transformer, almost, if you would?
Then you can still play those three or four cassettes that they made before, you know, they went to CDs.
Okay. How durable do you think Rumsey, Rumble and Frenzy would have been if they were CDs and not audio cassettes? I'm just curious.
The one punch and they get scratched. I mean, it's just not very good at all. Right. So Doctor Who. So the structure was they would do two CD sets. And they would structure it like the classic television. They would do 25-ish minute episodes. So one CD would have two episodes and have a 4-episode story. And that was the main. They just started doing that. And they hired writers from the Virgin New Adventures line. They hired writers who were actively doing novels. They hired writers from a television show. They hired brand new writers. They also wrote some stuff. A couple of scripts from the audio visuals eras were actually remade into audio adventures. But Paul McGann was the one that they couldn't get. Initially, and this is hilarious. I love this story because the reason why is Tegan Jovanka, because the actor who played Tegan Jovanka, Janet Fielding was actually Paul McGann's agent, and she said, "Paul, you are way too good of an actor to be working on this rinky-dink audio dramas thing." So she actually blocked it before Paul even knew the offer was on the table. So they negotiated with Janet Fielding for a while. That's also why, if you actually listen, a lot of the Fifth Doctor adventures, Tegan doesn't show up for a long time because Janet also didn't want to do this for a long time. She thought it was a fad. It wasn't going to go anywhere. She thought it was a fan production because she'd seen so many other fan production companies during the Wilderness years. And she was trying to protect her clients. So it was a lot. Doctor Who fans are outraged, but it was a logical step at the time, right?
So is it simply because it was a fan production, or is it also because she might have had some issues with Doctor Who itself as a show at that point in time?
I mean, a little bit of both. Even though they had the license, she still saw it as a glorified fan production. And when she's talked about this, and Paul has talked about this too, is that this is a man who was at that time still a pretty high catch for American movies. Now, that's one of the reasons why Fox wanted him for the 96 movie, is because he was a guy who's been in Aliens and other big budget pictures.
Wait, my friend. Don't oversell his role in Aliens. Let's talk about Aliens 3 that Paul McGann was in. And a lot of his scenes and roles that would have made a super cool character were cut. Let's give context. You say Aliens. People think he was with Sigourney Weaver in the first one. Wait, was one of the Space Marines in Aliens? No.
He was
on a prison planet. Yeah. All right. Please go ahead.
But the thing is like that he was, regardless of how bad that movie was and how it was, the point is he was making American movie money. And here's this rinky-dink British studio trying to get him on board. And she was concerned that if he came on board, that would be acknowledging that his value as an actor was not as high. She would already have diminished his value as an actor, and therefore he couldn't ask for those big movie parts. The other piece of it was, you're right, she was still pretty unhappy with how Doctor Who was run when she was on the show. And she had not seen anything to change her mind of that. And to be honest, she had gone to conventions and had seen how fans acted. And she's like, this is basically a fan studio production made good. So I don't think it's worth your time. So fast forward to 2001, Paul McGann does actually sign on board, partially because the other Doctor actors start talking to him privately. And they say, listen, no, they're really great. They pay on time. They pay well. It's monthly. So it's regular work. And it's pretty easy to do. You show up for a couple of days of recording and you're done.
Do you know
what
the pay is? We've mentioned pay a couple times. And
no one has given exact numbers, but a couple of actors have said that they, in their older years, have used Big Finish to basically make a living. The pay they make from working on Big Finish audios are enough to get them a comfortable living in their retirement.
Nice.
So that's one of the things that I love about Big Finish, is that ultimately it is that it's kind of a retirement home for Doctor Who actors. Like, listen, we love you. We're going to give you relatively light work to do things that you love to do and you're good at, and pay you enough that you can be comfortable. That's actually a really cool service in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah. I wish someone would do that for me.
Yeah, seriously. And we're jumping around a bit, but that's also the method they used to eventually get Tom Baker on board in 2014. That is the methods they used to get Christopher Eccleston on board eventually in 2018, 19, around there.
Who, if in case people aren't watching it, in True Detective Night Country, Christopher Eccleston is a supporting cast member.
Nice.
I know, because we're watching it. And if anyone says anything bad about it, I'm not your biggest fan, because I'm really enjoying it. And it would be a great game. Oh my God, that'd be a great game.
Really? Really? But yeah, actually, Chris Ruxton is under a touchdown, because one of the things they used to turn Janet Fielding around, Chris Ruxton is like going, we have Doctor Who license. We are not the people who made the Doctor Who television show. Because Chris Ruxton also had a very bad relationship with Doctor Who staff, and Darren Eccleston will never work with Doctor Who as long as certain people are involved with it. But he's working at Big Finish, because it's a different group of people.
I've got to say that I support him making a blatant statement up front saying, like, I will not do this because of these people, and this is my experience with it. It is rare that anyone will do that, because you take a bunch of feedback and it negatively impacts your career doing work. But it's your truth and you're sticking to it, and it's rare to see, and I want to say that I applaud it. I don't know enough about it to go into it, but I applaud that someone would make that statement and then hold to it, because in our industry, I see a lot of people make a bunch of bold statements, and then a week later, they've going and back and doing the exact thing they said they wouldn't do.
Right, exactly. But based on everything I've heard from Paul McGann in interviews, because one of the things we haven't talked about yet is that around 2006-ish, Big Finish realized they had a little bit of track left on each of the CDs, and so they started doing about 10 to 15 minutes of interviews with people after every story. And so there are now a lot of interviews with Paul McGann about all of these stories. Although the area we're looking at here, there aren't recorded yet. But Paul has talked about his time with the Eighth Doctor, and he's been pretty open by saying that he felt like he was excited about the opportunity, even though he was frustrated by the experience of filming that, and always felt like there was more potential for his character. And so that's one of the reasons why he did this, because if you look at the time frame now, 2001 is when the Eighth Doctor Adventures launched. January 2001 is the first one that arrives. The new Doctor Who was announced until 2004. So as far as Big Finish knew, and as far as Paul McGann knew, they were making the official Doctor Who. And so the people working on it genuinely felt they were basically making the continuing adventures of the Eighth Doctor. And this were official, these were canon, the whole nine yards. Because they at this point, it's been well over a decade. We had an aborted TV movie. Everyone figured the show was done. So they treated this like this was, they actually even structured it in seasons, right? So there are seasons of the Eighth Doctor. And so, you know, it's like, okay, this is, you know, just it happens to be on CD as opposed to on your television, but ultimately this is Doctor Who. This is officially Doctor Who. And that's what Paul treated this as. He treated this like a serious acting gig, just happened to be radio. There are some interesting wrinkles I won't necessarily go into, but suffice to say, how official these adventures are bounces back and forth a fair bit. At times, the Eighth Doctor adventures actually were on BBC radio and being broadcast. In fact, they're about to be done so again as a podcast. Well, actually, all the Doctors are now.
Yeah.
And one of the not on TV, but on all the DVDs and on YouTube videos for the show did have the Eighth Doctor citing characters from the Big Finish run. And a lot of people who worked on Big Finish stuff, a few of them went on to work on the original, like Nick Briggs. Nick Briggs is now the executive producer, one of the executive producers of Big Finish. And he's been working on the new series since 2005 as a voice actor. So, I mean, of all of the different things that came out of the Wilderness years, Big Finish is the one that probably has the most to say. They had a direct impact on the TV show, and they're still active today, right? They're still around today. They're even their monthly adventures that lasted until 2021. So that's 275 monthly releases, which is amazing for any kind of monthly production, frankly.
I would quibble a bit because I think the Virgin Books line's impact is just as large as Big Finish.
Fair, but they don't have as many people actively working on the current show now as the Virgin Books lines did. I mean, again, we could quibble because
we're in like minutia of like fractions right now with this discussion. But I would say that they may not. But without their success, Big Finish probably would not have been as successful to be able to do what they
did. No, that I agree with.
Without their constant work, so it's hand in hand. Both of them are critical and essential to the show that we have now.
No, I completely agree with that. And again, my argument of they thought they were making new Eighth Doctor adventures, their television show, is very similar to the spirit of the Virgin Books, where they thought they were doing the same thing with Seventh Doctor, right? Mm-hmm. It's not on TV, it's on a book. Now it's not TV, but it's on audio. They have a slight advantage of they were using actors that were actually involved with the show. But that's what I mean, like in terms of, because I'm also counting the actors. That's where I'm getting my numbers from. Because David Tennant actually worked on Big Finish stuff before he became a Doctor.
Well, David Tennant was also a big Doctor Who fan. So if you told him he could do anything Doctor Who, right, he would have been there. I could write a book and you'd have David Tennant there.
Right, no, seriously. And that was pretty much what it was. David Tennant, I think it was Nick Briggs, Man at a Party. And David Tennant was like, I have a role for a Nazi for you. And the Doctor's like, it's Doctor Who. I'll play a Nazi. Great.
He played an asshole unit commander before.
Oh, yes. One of the very few roles he's played in his actual normal accent, which is hilarious. Yeah, he plays an asshole Scottish unit commander, and it's actually really great.
Still one of my favorite Doctors of the day.
Yeah.
But Eddie,
yep, go ahead.
What did you think of the Night of the Doctor? We're talking about the Eighth Doctor shortly, so I'm curious what you thought of his portrayal leaving the Eighth books to go into live action again.
I honestly liked it. I'm mad because it's so short. But one of the things that's nice about Night of the Doctor is that a lot of times when you bring an actor back after a long period of time before they play the character, especially for a short bit like that, it's really hard for them to get back into that role, and they struggle with it. But Paul had been playing this character from his perspective for 15 years, right? So he slipped right in. And it was so full of like, it references the Brain of Morbius. It references the Big Finish adventures. It references and also, he gets a companion and a space adventure and gets through it all in like 5 minutes, right? It's super compressed Doctor Who. But if you're watching a YouTube video of a tie-in to a 50th anniversary of Doctor Who, you know what you're getting into. And so it's like, so they can jettison a lot of stuff. And the fact is that Paul McGann, it's due to how things have evolved, but Paul McGann's Doctor is in a lot of ways one of the most complicated and more most nuanced, because the Doctor in Night of the Doctor is slightly different from the one in the audio dramas, but also they have been slowly, carefully moving him in that direction over the course of decades now. And it's amazing because, like, the Doctor we're going to talk about today, if you go to listen to the latest Eighth Doctor adventure that released a few months ago, he's very different. But also, if you've listened to them all throughout, and I have, it's such a – there's a couple of big moments where he changes, but it's still a pretty slow process. And it's one of those things that, like, it clearly was not planned, but in retrospect, listening to all that, knowing he's going to become the War Doctor, especially after Night of the Doctor, is almost tragic. And Paul absolutely leans on that in such a wonderful way, because you get these sparks of the fun, vivacious Doctor, and then it goes slides back into all this horror that he has to shoulder, and it's a wonderfully nuanced performance.
And you would have to imagine that all the people that are making Doctor Who are, of course, fans of Big Finish, and were listening to it just how we were, or reading the books how we were, which they would have understood his journey and probably shaped what they were doing for him, and why it felt so good for that 5 minutes of time. It was like beautiful, and it makes you want an entire season run before that moment happens of McGann running around doing that.
Right. That's why if you were online late last year in 2023, when people were talking about spinoffs of it, you kept saying, do a Paul McGann Doctor Who spinoff. That's why, because he's got the movie star clout. He still looks fantastic at his age. He still got the energy at his age. And he has been, all the other living Doctors have now played their Doctor in Big Finish, right? So from 4th to 10th, I should take it back, not all of them, 4th to 10th, all have played Big Finish versions, but they're all played roughly out of sequence. Paul McGann is the only one that has had he has bounced back out of sequence of his own timeline, but he still has had a consistent series of adventures. So he has been playing the Doctor in a steady chronological arc the longest. Every other Doctor is trying to cram their adventures inside of televised end pieces.
Do you think you're going to keep doing that, though, now with the fact that there is bi regeneration?
Yeah. I mean, now that we know it's fucking nonsense. But it's also, I mean, now that we know the Tales of the TARDIS is basically canon, all those things are not weird. It's not an actor, an old actor trying to play a younger version. No. Those characters have aged now. They exist and they have aged. And it's like, okay, that's interesting, which also retroactively explains Time Crash, which is nice, because that needed to happen. But, you know, the nice thing is that the Eighth Doctor has had just a massive amount of adventures. And while we know the Doctor is old, and many of the incarnations of the Doctor imply that there are gaps of maybe even decades or centuries in their adventures that we just don't see, with the Eighth Doctor, you feel it on a very different level, right? So as Paul McGann has gotten older, it doesn't feel like there's this old guy trying to play a character I remember. It's like, no, I've more or less, my journey as Doctor Who fan has been pretty much following the Eighth Doctor. And that's why just the more we talk about the Eighth Doctor, the more and more frustrating 96 movie is, because 96 movie is the worst possible way to experience the Eighth Doctor, frankly.
And one of the things I love about The Big Finish is that they've created their own companions. And then what they've also gone and done is they've mixed companions in with other doctors. For instance, even with Charlie, who is the Eighth Doctor's companion, does adventure with the Sixth Doctor at one point in time. So like that is brilliant and something that we could have never done on the television show that they take advantage of in their medium. So that is the joy of experiencing something you love in various other mediums and what you can do with it that's different.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, because they are not producing a serialized television show, but rather dipping in and out of a number of eras of a television show. They could do a level of asynchronous storytelling that would just be impossible in normal television. So like you said, yeah, the companions sometimes go different directions. They have completely new canon characters. They also have a story like an arc where the Seventh Doctor meets a master, but then that master's plan actually gets uncovered by the Sixth Doctor, and then that master regenerates, and then both that master and the regenerating master end up actually fighting the Fifth Doctor, and so the Doctor's experiencing it backwards, but we're experiencing forwards from the master's perspective. And that kind of level of twist around is just, you can't really do it outside of things like comic books and novels, really.
And then they even go so far as to play with the medium that there is a Seventh Doctor and Mel adventure that was called like Flip Flop or something, that you could listen to either one in what order you wanted and it would still make sense. So they told the story that you could listen to it either way and it perfectly flows together. Like that is something television could not do. They could give there's you rewinds another, and times. But
there's another one called You Are Daleks. Where it's literally it's still a relic of the CD era, but basically it's, you can really jump to specific tracks based on what decision you make and choose your own adventure audio drama. And the fact that it's a choose your own adventure audio drama is part of the story. Although there is a First Doctor book that's a similar sequence, which is fascinating, called Ten Little Soldiers. But anyway, yes. Big
there's also a
experimental
a D&D choose your own adventure thing from like the 90s. I don't know if you remember that one. It came on like a DVD and put it in.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah.
There's a board game with that too.
Oh sorry to deviate a little bit, but you know what? I'm not sorry.
It leads into another point, which is that the other thing that's interesting about Big Finish, particularly in the era that we're talking about here, is that they did about a year of fairly traditional adventures, and then they started experimenting. Because again, like you said, a lot of them were either inspired by or had worked on the Virgin novels, which also became fairly experimental. And they started with Brittany Summerfield, so they're clearly very familiar with that era of Doctor Who. And so they tried a lot of different things, and so the Eighth Doctor inherited that, and so he was experimental pretty early on and becomes even more experimental until the relaunch of the new show, where they had to kind of bring the Eighth Doctor back to relatively traditional Doctor Who because they're worried the new fans of the new TV show would come back and find this weird ass Doctor Who shit on CD.
You mean like Zagreus, the episode that I almost chose, but then went, no, I'll go different. And then I went Neverland. And if you don't know these titles, they make no sense, but I want you to go and look them up. But Zagreus is kind of like the ending story of one of the seasons, basically.
Yeah.
And it is super out there that new fans would have went, what the fuck is this that I'm listening to?
Right.
So it's, they took chances, and that was incredible to see.
And I mean, Chams Knight is part of the kind of season two of the Eighth Doctor, and we're still, again, the individual stories are experimental, but the structure isn't. We're talking about Zagreus was basically the season finale. Neverland was the season penultimate.
Yeah.
So really, Neverland and Zagreus are kind of a two-parter, which covered five fucking discs. And if you weren't paying attention to the previous three seasons of Eighth Doctor, yeah, you'd
utterly lost.
What's going on. And utterly also, you had to pay attention to a specific Sixth Doctor adventure, and there's also a reference to one of the other Seventh Doctor adventures.
And so, a Fifth Doctor.
You basically had to pay attention to the monthly adventures as a line to really understand what's happening in those.
Before we get into it, because I think you have get into it energy now, I want to take a moment to say that with all this experimenting that Big Finish did, they exploded out and became unbelievably successful. And they got access to a bunch of other IPs. They have like a Pathfinder. They've got Holmes. They've got Blake 7. They've got Stargate. So many different ones because of the success that they did and the dedication they put into making something good.
Yeah.
And as a creative, I want to applaud that and get people to go and give them more money because I want to see what they do next.
That is actually a good point before going into this. Part of the reason I chose this one is because you can listen to it on Spotify. They've released the first 50-ish monthly adventures on Spotify for free, so you can go listen to them there. So it's easy to get access to it. Big Finish is not cheap. And on a good day, you're looking at $5 a disc, and it's closer to $10 for most sets. They're pretty expensive. But also, it is, to my mind, some of the best audio drama, just bar none, in the world. They've had 20 years to hone their craft. These people are professionals. They hire high-quality actors. There was a sale recently where they had on sale two of their Shakespeare plays. And so you have a lot of the Doctor Who and Jason actors doing Macbeth and King Lear. And they're just incredible to listen to because it's a little bit of music, a little bit of audio, but it's just them doing Shakespeare, and it just sounds because these are really good actors. You know, David Warner playing King Lear is just fantastic, you know. So they got Tom Baker to do Treasure Island, you know. I mean, so sometimes
you know that David Warner, you probably do know this one, but David Warner was their Unbound Doctor.
Yes. In fact, I just listened to their last set before he sadly passed away. He did an alternate version of the Eighth Doctor, and it's great. Just Big Finish are really good, but you do pay a premium for it. They know they're selling to fans with disposable income. That's their market. They have occasionally gone in different directions. They sell occasionally through Audible. They sell occasionally, like I said, they have the Spotify playlists. They're now doing a podcast called Into the TARDIS, where it's basically they actually chop it up into 30-minute episodes again, and they release every Friday. So it's kind of like watching the old TV show. You get a half-hour episode every Friday, but also it has Colin Baker doing the intro and outros for those.
And they also put on a bunch of sales. Their pricing is also tiered, that if you want older material, they've reduced the price of the older material almost to, if you wanted to buy Chimes of Midnight right now, you could get it for, I think, $350.
Yeah.
So it shows you that they're building something, and the newer stuff is, of course, more expensive. It's just like comics. Like, new stuff is more expensive. The older it gets, they lower the price until it gets down to it's dirt cheap. But the thing is, you're paying them a premium because you're getting a premium product.
Yep.
And one of the things is that I, as a creator, want people to know is that it costs money to make anything. And it costs a lot of money to make something decent to good.
Right.
So.
And yeah, Big Finish is good. But yeah, I mean, I'm with you. Like, listen to this stuff for free. I think the first 100 monthly adventures are like in the $5 range now. So try it. And if you like it, I will say right now, the Eighth Doctor's been in a pretty long run with a new companion and team. Livchenka is fantastic. And also they've been dipping in and out of the Time War with the Eighth Doctor now. But also the Eighth Doctor's in a nice place because since he's kind of in the middle ground between classic and modern day, they've been starting to blend the lines between the modern Doctor Who and class Doctor Who with the Eighth Doctor stuff. So like, for example, there was one run, which I'm in the middle of, called Stranded, where the TARDIS breaks down and he's stuck on Earth in 2020. So he's handling some of his threads from his past adventures, but also the curator from Day of the Doctor, when Tom Baker played, is actually a character. It's not Tom Baker playing the Fourth Doctor. Tom Baker playing some incarnation of the Doctor known as the curator now, who's involved in this, which is just amazing.
Ridiculousness.
Anyway, I can talk about Vic Finch all day. We should talk about this story.
All right. You know what? I'll let the other thing. I'll let my other quibble go. We can talk about the story.
Okay. What's your quibble?
I've voiced it before, so I don't need. You know, I'm going to talk about the diversity in casting.
Oh, it has not been good at this era, particularly.
And I've mentioned it before in a podcast, so that's why I was willing to let it go this time. But while I give them a bit kudos for being experimental in like the format and what they're doing with it, I do not give them that for the casting choices they've made. It is still 90 to 95% white people.
I'm glad you brought that up because if you follow Big Fish and his company over 20 years, what has happened over 20 years is that their storytelling has gotten more conservative in the sense of they're more like traditional Doctor Who stories, not conservative in politics, but conservative in the sense of if you pick up a random box set, you're probably going to get a generally relatively straightforward Doctor Who adventure. They occasionally do experimental stuff, but not often. But on the flip side, their casting and their writing teams have gotten a lot better. One of their bigger writers, Attack X, I think his name is Brazilian. He's been doing a lot of stuff lately. They've hired a lot more actors of color, particularly to voice characters that are supposed to be the appropriate ethnicity. They've also, one of the, again, Stranded, there's a trans character who's played by a trans actor. So, I mean, they're definitely doing better on that front over the past, let's say, 5 years. But early 2000s, they were still clearly figuring their shit out. They were just hiring people that were around them, which generally were white men. Again, that's something that
I know people like to say that, but I don't believe it. I don't adhere to it. If your circle of friends is only white people, then you need to expand your circle.
Oh, I agree.
And if given the fact that if we look at the Seventh Doctor era, where they were trying their best on with a network, forcing their hand, but they were making roles like Bambera. I forgot her name, but she was Ace's sidekick in like the Battlefield. They were making active choices on television before this came out under like a regime. And this is people that eventually got a license and had free will to do what they wanted to do. It right. Would not have been that difficult to hire more diversely, even at that point in time.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I will point out, however, that the BBC clearly did not give a fuck when they first got the license. So there was no longer a company going, hey, you need to push more diversity.
I'm actually saying the exact opposite, that the BBC was limiting the diversity of the TV show when it was on. And when Big Finish got the license, they didn't have that limiting factor. They could have hired anyone the fuck they wanted to.
Fair. Okay. But again, like I said, I mean, we're talking about broad strokes here. I mean, there was a Companion Chronicles run, which were basically audiobooks, but narrated by people who played actors in the story. And then they have one other guest actor on there. And there was a 3 audio run of the First Doctor Companion Chronicles, which featured a black gay man in the 60s. And they were like, you know, here's the double hit of being both of those things in the 60s in England. So they really kind of addressed that. But that was, again, just 3 stories. It's only been the past 5 years where it's been pretty clear that diversity is not actually filtering down through all the lines and something that they're consistently interested in.
And I don't remember it well enough to speak to it, which is why I didn't really bring it up. But I want to say about 5 years ago for a Big Finish, there was a controversy with someone on their staff and bad views or takes on people from other communities. I don't remember it well enough to talk about it.
I think that is
because you keep coming back to that 5-year mark, and that is around the time that controversy happened. That's like
right.
Someone slapping your company hand and you're going, oh, you're right. You caught us.
No. Okay. So I know what you're talking about. They hired someone, James Dreyfuss, to play a different incarnation of the Master. He's supposed to play the Master that happens in the first, second Doctor era. He did, in fact, say some stuff out, and then he was fired by Big Finish shortly afterwards. So I mean, I'm not trying to excuse this stuff. And again, the era we're talking about, it's not great. But to me, it seems like a company that is genuinely trying to do better. And in fact, they got a lot of shit by the community because, like, why'd you fire this guy? Just because this guy got to go on GB News, which is basically it's Fox News for England. And was like, I was canceled by Big Finish and I didn't even say anything wrong. So, I mean, like, you know, they've gotten the hot water from the opposite side of this for doing that. But, you know, they also recently they're going to have, I'm not sure the timeline. The Sixth Doctor's getting a wheelchair bound companion. Wheelchair user. Apologies. And they've hired an actor who uses a wheelchair to play that. And a lot of people are like going, it's audio. I can't see them. Why does it matter? It's like,
Still matters. It's
their lived experience, and they're going to bring that to the role in a way that someone who doesn't have a lived experience can't.
And so one of the reasons I didn't remember all the details of that. So thank you. But one of the reasons I didn't bring it up at the top of the show, how we do a lot of things, is because they've made an active choice to change over the past number of years. But that doesn't excuse the choices they made at the start when they could have done better, coming from a show that in itself was fighting a regime and power structure to do better. That is dropping the ball.
Yeah, that is fair. And I think it's fair to say that while we're saying we're holding them accountable to it, I think it's also fair to say it seems like Big Finish itself is also holding itself accountable and trying to do better, which is something we like to see. So we may ding them for that, but they've made active efforts and they're not perfect. Nobody is. But
what? I am Mary fucking Poppins over here. I'm practically perfect in every way. You let me open it up and you let me do it. Oh, and he wasn't expecting it. His whole face dropped.
The worst part is not only that, but it's like, yes, you said that, but that was a fucking Peacemaker reference. I'm just so proud of you.
Actually, it was a Yondu reference from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, was it Yondu? I thought it was Peacemaker that had the Mary Poppins gag.
He may have stolen it, but it was Yondu from Mary Poppins from Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Okay. My apologies. Anyway.
Yeah.
45 minutes ago. Let's talk about the story. Yeah.
but here you go. Eagly and I agree. Boo!
There you go. Part 1. The Doctor and Charlie land somewhere that the TARDIS cannot even identify, and they decide to explore. The Doctor's trying to get her to Singapore. It's part of the ongoing storyline of Doctor and Charlie Parlard. The home resembles Charlie's old home, and they discover that their interactions with the house undo themselves after a while, so things go back to the way they were before. Charlie accidentally knocked over a jar of jam, and when Doc returns to TARDIS to get some tools and exits, he notices the jar is back on the table, having reset itself, and the stain on Charlie's dress has disappeared, among other strange happenings in the house, including Charlie writing her name in the dust, only for it to immediately disappear. Meanwhile, a scullery maid named Edith is ordered around the house to do menial chores and is treated poorly by all the household, including her master, Mr. Shaughnessy, and kitchen maid, Mrs. Baddeley. The Doctor and Charlie discover they've arrived on Christmas, but the house is abandoned. Charlie hears a faint voice singing Hark the Herald Angels Sing, while Edith hears Charlie's faint voice ordering the Doctor to the freshly prepared turkey. To continue to explore, Owen discovers it's very difficult to make impressions on the surrounding environment. They manage to find a way to interact with it, but to the Doctor's disturbance, the house environment begins to taunt them. Frederick finds and calls off his relationship with Mary after being forced by Mr. Baddeley, but Mary has had other plans. Charlie, who seems to be able to hear Edith, is prompted by the Doctor to find the source of the voice when she suddenly stumbles onto Edith taking a bath. They converse and find themselves getting along well when suddenly Charlie hears another Edith say that she, Edith, is going to die soon. Charlie, frightened, calls out for the Doctor and finds she can talk to him, and he reveals they need to return to the TARDIS. She comments he's scared, which he acknowledges, claiming some mysteries are best left alone. However, they hear a scream, a clock chime, and the Doctor realizes they are now trapped. So, first off, in all of our talk about the Eighth Doctor, completely forgot to mention Charlotte Pollard.
Not true.
Charlie. Okay, well, did we talk
about mentioned that she adventured with the Eighth Doctor and the Sixth Doctor.
Okay, fair enough.
We didn't say who she was or shit about her.
So, Charlotte Pollard, Edwardian adventuress.
Love it.
Is the Doctor's current, as of the story, companion. She was a girl who ran away from her family to travel on the R101 airship, which famously crashed. And also famously, everyone died on, but she didn't. His Doctor saved her, and this is an ongoing storyline as to her being saved is causing problems with time. So by the time we get to this story, we are not sure whether Charlie is responsible for what's going on or not, but something weird is going on with Tom right now.
And so, I mean, Charlie, for a long time, if you were listening, for as they dropped each one, was the Doctor's companion for a long time. Like, yeah, a lot of the run.
So Charlie was companion from 2001 to 2006. Because she was written out to make... So there's a weird digression, but there's a weird overlap. There was another series of Eighth Doctor's Adventures made specifically to tie into the new series because Radio 4, I think, wanted some Doctor Who audio dramas.
That's with Lucy Miller, right?
And there's Lucy Miller. So those started when Charlie was technically still companion, so they had to do an exit story with Charlie so they released out of order, but ultimately Charlie gets dropped off. Eighth Doctor then picks up Lucy Miller and then goes on to have adventures with her.
And Lucy Miller has very much has a Donna-esque vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is weird because that was before Donna even happened. So again, how much of that influence goes in which direction is interesting.
But anyway, we're not here to talk about Lucy Miller or Donna.
Well, so it's kind of weird. I'm struggling a bit to figure out how to talk about this, right? Because it's audio, I can't really talk about the visuals. I can't talk about.
Well, you could go a different direction. We could get all Lynch with it, Eddie. When you listen to it, what appeared in your mind's eye? Were there flickering lights that you then clenched onto as you envisioned it?
No. I will say, though, that one of the things that's like, if this has been done as a TV show, which there's a spoiler reason why it couldn't have been done. But if it were, this would be all shot on one set, right? It would be like, you know, they would get the house and it starts and ends more or less in the house.
So kind of a trap room thing.
Right. So because of the way they describe it, it feels very claustrophobic, which is something else that audio does really well, right? Audio does intimacy very, very well because it's like you said, it's being, you're imagining it and you're hearing, it's being put directly into your ears, typically usually headphones or whatever. So it feels very kind of intimate and close. And that's something that this script takes advantage of to some level. It does mean that you have to have a little knowledge of understanding how to listen to audio drama. Because it's a bit like reading comics, right? Like there's a grammar and a structure to comics that you have to understand before you can really figure out what's on the page, right? The fact that things happen between panels and panel order and you know, reading left to right versus right to left, depending on if you're reading manga. Audio is the same way, which means that the characters have to describe what's happening to them. And Big Finish are really good at making it seem seamless as dialogue. But this is definitely an era where they're still not perfect at it. And so there's a lot of Charlie saying, let me write my name in here. Oh, that's weird. It disappeared. You know, but that's a bit, the network entirely goes away. There's a bit of audio drama where you have to kind of accept that people are just going to over-explain their actions.
Well, then you've done it to some extent, but do you want to give a quick 30-second 101 about how people should listen to audio dramas? As we may do additional audio dramas in the future, it sort of sets a baseline for what people to help them engage and figure out how they want to do it.
I equate audio drama a lot of ways to Shakespearean drama. Like if you watch Shakespeare play where there's a guy just takes a break and turns and talks to the audience, that's not the character doing that. That is a conceit to allow the audience to see a character's inner monologue. Same way is like in audio drama, people talk to themselves a lot. And so you're going to have situations where they're going to say something nice to someone. That person's going to allegedly walk out of the room and then immediately they turn and start saying something awful, right? We have to assume things like that other character didn't hear that unless we're told otherwise.
So in one sense, if they want a visual representation, it's kind of like in the case of Azentrani when the lead bad guy would turn to the side and talk to us. Or if we want to go for Hustle, it's sometimes you'd see Mickey say one thing, then turn and talk to us.
Yeah, those are both things that audio drama uses very, very well, that kind of talking to the audience. Now, Big Finish, what they try to do generally is they try to make it sound like it could have been the audio track from a television show that never happened. So they do try to, especially later years, they get very good at this. They try to make it sound as naturalistic as possible. But also they try to write to their strengths. And this is ultimately, really this entire story is a bunch of people talking to each other, which is where audio drama, frankly, is best. But it does mean that Charlie, especially in her earlier adventures, there's no good way to say this, she sounds a bit dim because she's constantly showing surprise and explaining things that seem to be, it should be very obvious if you're in that scene. But that's one of the conceits of audio drama, is like she has to do that because we can't see what's happening.
Well, also, but the Doctor also comes off as an ass. I'm going to take us back to the beginning where they first show up and Charlie's in a dark environment and the Doctor is hanging out in the TARDIS with a torch but won't give it to her. Just fill around, Charlie. See what your figures can encounter. Is kind of a weird starting conceit for it.
Sure, and that's something else about the Eighth Doctor and Charlie dynamic is that the modern equivalent is they're trolling each other, right? They are the kinds of friends that they make fun of each other. That's a very specific style of friendship. And it's very different from many other Doctor Who relationships we've seen prior to this. So the Eighth Doctor loves Charlie. That's almost one of his catchphrases at this stage. It's like, yeah, I love you. You're my friend. I love you. But also, he is not above poking her a bit. And his sense of humor is not always in line with the audience's sense of humor, which is a very great way for Paul McGann to make him alien yet approachable.
In short, it could have also been a better version of the Sixth Doctor and Perry's relationship if they had done it correctly back then.
Yep. Yeah, that little glimpse we saw of them in the story that you covered is kind of, at a very broad level, what the Eighth Doctor and Charlie relationship is. That's a really good point. And
so then, Eddie, I've watched the Eighth Doctor movie, and I know that he's half human. Is that true when I come to these audio adventures? If he says he loves Charlie, none of the other Doctors talk about loving people, so it must be because he's human. Is that correct? At least half human on his mother's side.
The best way to explain this is that with one exception, and that's a fairly recent exception, the movie is not considered to be canon with the Eighth Doctor Adventures at all. The Eighth Doctor exists. He regenerated some adventure that never happens, and now he's here. And that's what happens. The one exception, of course, is that Eric Roberts is now, in fact, playing the Master in Big Finish, and he is amazing. I'm just saying, listening to Missy flirt with the Eric Roberts Doctor is wonderful. But anyway, but yeah, so a lot of that stuff, just like Grace, 1999, all that stuff just generally gets glossed over. And so if you listen to it from the very first adventure, except from Where Did This New Doctor Come From, which frankly is how the Death of Life series actually started, it's more or less self-contained. So there's no reference to being half human, although that is a weird plot point for a Sixth Doctor adventure of all things. You know, the Master is not the Master that we saw in that movie, so on and so forth.
All right. Then I am curious, out of all the Eighth Doctor adventures we could have chose, before we get any more into this, why did you choose this one?
Because it has the right vibe of what I think is peak Eighth Doctor Charlie, right? Which is, this is Doctor Who kind of trying to play with fantasy a bit more. It's kind of specifically that kind of Victorian Edwardian fantasy, which makes sense because Charlie is Edwardian herself. But also, it was either this or Schizo, which is really hard to get into if you don't know the premise of what's going on with Schizo. But this is also, as much as I said, if you don't know how to listen to audio drama, it can sound a little patronizing. This really is high quality audio drama because, I mean, this does a really good job of painting a picture by keeping the space limited, by having a strong cast of characters, and doing something that really only an audio drama can do, which is that you're assuming you're listening to this more or less back to back, so it can play and refine and evolve themes in a way that if you're watching a television show week to week, you would lose some of the connections there. You have to really listen to these one after another to get some of the nuances and subtleties that are happening in the story.
Because the first time I listened to this, it reminded me a lot of Ghostlight. A lot of Ghostlight, not just because they're trapped in a mansion. And well, because they're trapped in a mansion, they go back to one of the companions, like key touchstones or changing moments at part of their life. And it has a lot of similarities to it. And part of me thinks that is because it was so early in the Big Finish's run of releasing Doctor Who stories. And Ghostlight is an incredible story that everyone should check out.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. I mean, that's a good point. This is an era where there's a little bit of, we can improve on some rougher areas of classic Doctor Who. I mean, there's a couple of Seventh Doctor stories that are clearly retreads of Mel era stories done with Ace now, which kind of feel like, but Mel's a bit crap, so let's do this better with Ace now. Which I don't agree with, but you know, they exist. And even there's a couple of stories that were written in the era of the Virgin novels. So it has Bernice and Ace as the team with Seventh Doctor. So I would not be surprised if there was some portion of, let's do Ghostlight, but with more room.
So how did you like them actually engaging with the environment before they get drawn into it?
I mean, I think this is one of the places where it, if you just listen to isolation, it probably sounds a bit weak because it feels like it's a bit repetitive and a bit, I mean, spend 25 minutes bouncing around a house, right? And talking to people. It feels like nothing happens. And every time something happens, it ultimately gets reset. But I do like it because it's telling you what kind of story it is. And especially if you're listening to, frankly, if you're listening to a Doctor Who audio drama, you're probably some flavor of Doctor Who fan, which means a time loop is not going to be a weird concept for you. So it's efficient in that regard.
Even though when you're listening to it, I felt when I was listening to it that there was a lot, even the first time, there was a lot going on because you have the Doctor and Charlie stuck in their sort of own weird time loop. But at the same time, you have the underlying story with Edith and the downstairs staff going on. Mm-hmm. And you're waiting for those two to link and you don't know why. So it's adding in that mystery layer already for you.
Sorry, you're right. I should clarify. I'm not saying nothing happens. A lot happens because it took me a lot to read that. The Doctor and Charlie don't do much is more what I meant.
Come on. They open a Christmas cracker, Eddie. Like that is that is high tier action.
They write their name in the dust. high quality jam jar action. You know, I mean, it's... But also, I mean, in a way, as much as we talked about it harkens back to classic, it also harkens to a certain degree to 60s Doctor Who, right? Because there's a fair bit of 60s Doctor Who where the first episode is them just exploring their environment. And so there's also a nod towards that to a certain degree, which I appreciate because it's done better. And I think you've correctly put your finger on the reason why it's done better is the fact that there is a subplot happening that is equally strange, but the Doctor and Charlie are not directly engaged with, and in fact literally can't engage with at the start.
And it's highlighted by the fact, just from your opening quote, how even in the subplot it's weird right away. Like they get obsessed with a plum pot. Like what? Why is this like your conversational topic for all things? And Edith being unimportant.
Right.
And it's constantly reinforced, like letting you know that this is going to be critical for you to understand, which is why I think you're choosing this was a great one, because it is almost like an introductory audio experience for people from how it's laid out and how it's structured.
Yeah, no, honestly, if people, when I pitch people like going, hey, I want to try out Big Finish, where should I start? This is one of the stories I usually point them to, because it is, if you're not into this vibe, you're probably not going to be into the Charlie and Eight, frankly, because this is them, not them at their peak, but I mean, this kind of weirdness and also supremely low stakes, right? Weirdly, the Eighth Doctor is not good at high stakes stuff. That changes over time, but this version of the Doctor, of the Eighth Doctor. When he gets into high stakes stuff, he's rubbish. Which is a nice contrast to Seven, right? Because Seven's all like, you know, I must overthrow the ancient gods of the universe, and Eight's like, but there's a cool house I want to go look at. And I kind of love that about the Eighth Doctor. Because McGann's really good at balancing, let me put the weight of my knowledge into my voice and then talk about absolute nonsense.
And although it gives a great example of the this new incarnation of the Doctor, who he's figuring out roughly the time period based on their surroundings and providing mm-hmm. you points of reference. And you get a fact of Charlie picking up on some of those and bouncing around, which very much, again, feels like the Sixth Doctor and Pear's relationship, where he's kind of like a mentor for her. And you were getting to see that as they're piecing everything together.
Well, and that's actually another good point that I had forgotten, is that as much as the Eighth Doctor is teasing Charlie about, hey, feel around, one thing he's doing, which is closer to Seven, but otherwise no Doctor Boy did, which is let the companion actually have some good moments. That's something that Charlie and Eight are pretty good from the get-go. Charlie is absolutely a strong, in terms of narratively strong companion in her own right. She's interesting. She's compelling. She does not take bullshit well. And she calls the Doctor on his nonsense pretty frequently. So we see kind of the next step of that march towards the modern day companions we talked about back when Survival. It's like, this is okay. Ace was moving in that direction, but Ace didn't quite start there. What if you had a companion from the start who had this relationship, and how would that look?
Mm-hmm. And what I don't understand, and this is probably the biggest thing I have for it, is why is a Doctor obsessed with figuring out this one mystery?
Right.
Because they just show up at random. And then when they realize they're about to get into the mystery, he's like, run away! Back to the TARDIS!
Weirdly, bit of a digression. Around this time, Big Finish didn't really have a way to communicate with fans. The internet wasn't quite where it was. So they had a website, but not much else. And so they released Big Finish Magazine, which was a CD they gave away free at places, which had a whole bunch of interviews and stuff. They have, over the years, been steadily releasing those digitally and giving away for free. And one of them happened to have an interview with all the writers of the season of The Eighth Doctor. So it was actually a whole CD called The Eighth Doctor Interviews, I think. And so it was all about this season and the next season. And so Robert Sherman, who wrote this, actually talked a bit about this story. And he said that there was plans to have the Doctor increasingly worried about, minor spoilers for season two, Charlie is a space-time event because she's both dead and alive. And that becomes an increasing problem throughout season two of The Eighth Doctor Adventures. So the reason why he's investigating this, one of the things that kind of got lost was that he was worried that he was not investigating this scenario. He's investigating if it was Charlie doing it, but that kind of got lost in the script. And he admits that. The reason why he's trying to run away is because he realized, nope, not Charlie, something else, got to go. And they can't.
All right. I'm ready to move on. If you don't have anything else about this one, because this is our build-up episode.
Yeah, right. It's good. Part two. They find Edith drowning, and while the Doctor tries to save her, she dies. The household comes to investigate the commotion and thinks she died by accidental suicide, but the Doctor suspects otherwise because he thinks it's murder. They then reveal they were expecting the Doctor, claiming he's Chief Inspector of Scotland Yard, to arrive and investigate. Mr. Shaughnessy tells the Doctor that he has access to anywhere he likes and question whoever he wants, and tells the household staff to answer every one of his questions except those concerning the going-ons of the house. Doctor tells Charlie he has an unnerving feeling, but they ought to play along, saying he suspects the murder and the time anomaly are linked when Charlie asks what task he should be focusing on. He and Charlie split up, like all good companion teams do, and he interviews Shaughnessy while Charlie interviews Mr. Baddeley. Baddeley refuses to help Charlie since she won't taste her plum pudding, while the Doctor learns about the residents of the house from him, and Shaughnessy says he suspects Mrs. Baddeley. Charlie relents and tries some plum pudding, but ends up aiming strangely and catching herself, excusing herself after asking Baddeley whom she suspects, and Baddeley reveals she suspects Shaughnessy because he has shifty eyes, which is the same reason Shaughnessy gave to the Doctor. Doctor interviews Frederick, the chauffeur, and Charlie interviews Mary, both claiming they're accused of having also have shifty eyes. Suddenly, Charlie hears Edith again, who reveals she needs to find out who murdered her to not forget her, and that another murder will occur, and finally, that Edward Grove is alive. We've never met Edward Grove. Charlie yells at the doctor to find her, but they discover that Mrs. Baddeley has been the next victim and has been stuffed with her own pudding. The household believe in another suicide, and the doctor asks them to leave so he can consult with Charlie. He reveals he suspects they are playing a game, and they know a few things, that the murders occur on the hour, and something strange occurs each time, such as Mrs. Baddeley being stuffed with her own pudding. Charlie realizes the murders are occurring too quickly to be an hour apart, and an impressed doctor reasons the killer must be speeding up time, and they set off to find a clock. Frederick and Mary meet, and their warped perception of the events begin to take hold as they forget about Edith and reaffirm their devotion to each other. The doctor and Charlie find Sean the same and ask for his pocket watch, but he refuses. They decide that they will go upstairs to find the grandfather clock that keeps striking, but Sean the same holds them at gunpoint. Doctor then tricks Sean the same to give up his pocket watch, and they end up not going upstairs. Doctor explains to Charlie the entity sees them as a threat, but cannot work out how to respond to them, which is why he is able to convince Sean the same. They find the watch behaving strangely and call the house members together to see what will happen and who may be murdered, only to find out they cannot remember Edith. They split up again despite the doctor's warnings, claiming there is a household work to return to, and the grandfather clock again strikes midnight. So now we see the structure and what's really great about the story. I couldn't really kind of go into it earlier on, but each episode shifts the story into a new genre a little bit. And also, every episode so far has ended with the clock striking. So it's a nice, solid structure, which is the doctor and Charlie find something weird going on, try to figure out the rules of where they're at now, and the clock will strike and a murder will happen. Now we now know this is the structure of the story based on these two parts. So we move from a weird kind of ghost story that they can't put their hand into. Now suddenly, they're in a very Agatha Christie style mystery story, and indeed a parody of Agatha Christie style mystery stories. Because the ironic death is very much a Christie staple. So the fact that someone died choked their own pudding is not the surprising part at all. Of course, these are things that happen in these kinds of stories. The fact that everyone assumes it's a suicide is the weird part for all the other characters.
Do I need to do it?
Go for it.
Who's Christy?
I thought you explained Agatha Christie in one of our previous episodes.
Did I?
Yes, I think you did.
Dang it. All right. We can move on then.
Hoisting your own petard.
It only take you 2 years to do it.
So, I mean, again, this is one of those things where now the Doctor and Charlie are actually having an active role in things. And the Doctor is still being mysterious. One thing I like about Eight in this era is that they haven't gotten rid of the Doctor's mystery, right? They're keeping that. The Doctor is still mysterious and alien. But what's good is that it's not at Charlie's expense anymore. Again, we saw this in season 26. We're seeing it more clearly now. Charlie's getting a chance to fill her own role. She doesn't have the same knowledge the Doctor does, but she is noticing things that he either didn't notice or is pretending he didn't notice. And that's one thing that's interesting about 8 is that it's never entirely quite sure which. 7, we're pretty convinced that he's a manipulator, so anytime he's like, oh, I didn't notice that, you assume he's lying, because based on how we've set up. With 8, he genuinely does get kind of distracted at times, so he may not have noticed it only took an hour to for that murder. That may have been something Charlie genuinely brought to his attention, but the way he acts, it's a little unclear whether that's true or not. And that's what I like about this relationship, is that the Doctor, because of the way he's being played, gives Charlie some room to have a strong role in the narrative.
Well, is it that, or is it also because the Doctor is more susceptible to what's going on than Charlie is? Because we've already established, even in the previous episode, Charlie could hear Edith when the Doctor couldn't. There are other points here where Charlie has a perception that the Doctor doesn't have. And is that simply because the story is so intrinsically linked to her and not to him?
Well, that's a clue towards what we're going to get to. The fact that this is more of Charlie's story than the Doctor's story. But what's also happening here, and that's an interesting point, I'm glad you brought it up, is that it starts off, episode 1, it feels like it's very much a Doctor story. It's a time loop. We know how time loops work, right? And again, this is a story that's written to its audience to some level. It is written to Doctor Who fans. We don't have to explain what a time loop is. And so I was like, well, this is a very doctorish mystery. But then the doctor opts out near the end of episode one. It's like, nope, we're not investigating this mystery, which seems like a weird thing for him to do, because like, it seems like exactly the kind of thing he'd want to investigate. And now we're in episode two. The doctor is the detective, but Charlie's the one that's actually finding all the clues, because this is her time period. This is her culture on some level, right? This kind of house is a place where she grew up. So we're starting to realize, oh, this is more of Charlie's story, and the doctor is her companion on some level. But he's still – so his role as detective is assigned to him, and it seems like at the first like he's going to actually solve the mystery. But what's actually ends up happening is he just goes through the motions. Like if his conversation with Shaughnessy frequently says, well, as a detective, you know you should be doing this. Well, you're absolutely right. The doctor's just playing along with what Shaughnessy is telling him his job is. So the doctor is, and he explicitly says, we need to play a part. Let's play these parts. So the doctor is recognizing he's in some kind of narrative, but we as the audience are starting to suspect that it's actually Charlie's narrative on some level. It's interesting. Anyway, if you have nothing else, I'll move on to part three.
I will point out that I liked the discovery of the time period, because as a history buff, one of the things I look for is how people figure out what time they're in if they don't know based on the surroundings. And you get that exchange between Freddie and the doctor about the Bentley or Chrysler and what year it was made. And you get little slower progressions like that throughout it to sort of signal in that supposedly they were in 1904, but there are things that conflict with them being in 1904, which goes back to Charlie, who we know came from like 1930, and so much of the house overlapping, but not being her time period.
Yeah, it's neat that what starts off as what could have been just historical inaccuracies turns out to be a clue. And you're right, the car conversation is a good way to kind of broadcast to the audience that this is intentional and something strange is going on. I mean, aside from completely forgetting a murdered scullery maid.
But Edith's not important. She's nothing.
Right, and that's one of the interesting threads going on is that, I don't want to spoil. Normally we don't worry about spoilers, but it's important for this one because each episode reveals a new piece. But I do want to say at least that one thing I love about this is that it's very good. Each episode says, here's what the mystery is. And then the next episode goes, that's not what the mystery is. Here's what the mystery is. And it turns out none of those are true. This story gives you three different mysteries and it's actually a fourth one. So each episode is just completely changing the premise of the story, which is fascinating.
And it's also interesting. I'll touch back on this, how the doctor is a chief inspector and Charlie is just his niece, which goes back to show you, given the time period, that is the assumption of what their roles would be and how they couldn't have been any different.
Right.
Which in of itself touches back on Charlie's story of being an adventuress and fleeing home to live a bigger life. And being shuffled back into a role of just being someone's niece.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, it's without spoiling anything, the roles that people play and how they treat each other, turns out that is a big part of what's going on in the story. It's not just historical detail. Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting.
And my last comment, then we can move on. That I hope that plum pie was that good.
It wouldn't be Christmas, Chris. All right, part three. Doctor and Charlie are returned to the scullery and find that things have reverted back, then find Edith dead, having suffocated to death by a plunger. The household members find them with Mrs. Baddeley still alive and the events of before having repeated themselves, seeming as if the two have gone back in time. This time, the Doctor and Charlie find a third scribble in the dust with the name Edward Grove and attempt to deduce what is happening. The two split again to investigate. That worked so well last time. The doctor questions Frederick and asks him to take him for a drive, but Frederick refuses, then attempts to open the door to go outside, but the two reveal their master has instructed to kill them if he attempts to leave. The doctor decides to play along further, and Frederick and Mary say they suspect they killed Edith. Charlie, in the meantime, questions Mrs. Baddeley and discovers some of her more disturbing traits. The doctor learns that Frederick and Mary were to kill Mrs. Baddeley, but don't remember who Edith is. Mrs. Baddeley disturbs Charlie, saying she's already died. A confused Charlie is then contacted mentally by Edith, who says she is forgetting her and mentions Edward Grove, and finally doesn't understand why she had to die, but Charlie can live. Just then, another death occurs, this time Frederick's. However, Mary is thought to be a scullery maid, despite Charlie trying to remind him of Edith, and they all resume their work. The doctor and Charlie attempt to understand what they've misunderstood, and Charlie storms out when the doctor tries to explain that she's misremembering things. Charlie goes to find Edith's dust signature, but it's disappeared, and Edith appears to Charlie, saying she's forgetting her, they need to find Edward Grove. The doctor attempts to go to the Forbidden upstairs and is stopped by Shaughnessy holding him at gunpoint again, revealing that Shaughnessy is manipulated by an outside force that he himself reveals he doesn't feel in control. The doctor then has Shaughnessy confirm his suspicions that the name Edward Grove is actually the name of the house. The doctor explains that it's the house doing the murders. The household are called into action to kill the doctor, and in the process, they call forth Charlie, who has also come under the control of the house. However, as the clock strikes 12, time is reversed, and the doctor reveals that it seems the entity itself doesn't have complete control. They arrive back in the scullery where Edith has been clubbed to death this time, and the household, forgetting the fire details, goes back to their duties. The doctor explains to Charlie that the house is performing this and is slowly trying to make her and the doctor part of its narrative. He reveals that all the traumatic memories that have happened here may have been absorbed by the house, causing its sentience. The doctor tells Charlie they return to TARDIS as they're in a trap, and while the household tries to stop them, they manage to leave. Inside the TARDIS, the doctor reveals that if they had brought any bit of paradox with them, they'd be trapped. Charlie's a paradox. Whoops. Just then, Charlie hears the grandfather clock striking again. The console disappears, and the house begins to reform around them, and the doctor realizes they haven't escaped the house, but instead brought it with them. And now the story becomes literally just a surreal novel. And I have to admit, man, the first time I listened to this story and I heard the Edward Grove is the house, I lost my shit. Because I was like, it's the house? What?
But then that makes sense because all their private conversations that they've been having have also been influencing each new scenario they're in her, because right. Charlie says that she would have rather been like famous private investigators in the house, and the people start referring to them as like those famous private investigators instead of being a chief constable. So it shifts its own narrative to what they want to try to get more of their buy-in.
Right. And so the story going from this is a time loop to this is a murder mystery to this is a mystery about narrative. Like, this is a literally a story about stories, and they are somewhat trapped in the narrative. And the fact that the Eighth Doctor just rattles off, oh yeah, the house is probably alive because it absorbed bad memories, and just moves on. Like, that is a perfectly normal sentence that everyday people say. And Charlie's like, what?
It is beautiful because the name Edward Grove sounds like it could be a real person's name, or it could be a house's name. It's beautiful. People don't understand how hard it is when you're writing or doing anything to come up with a good name, like a good name.
Yeah.
And hours of your life wasted.
one of the things that we see in episode 3, now I think I start talking about things because you're right. Episode 1 was kind of just set up, is that the episode now have been repeating things. And we've now moved a stage where they're repeating things, but each time the repetition, there's a change. We recognize that. And the characters seem starting to recognize the narrative structure they're in. But the Edward Grove bomb has been reiterated, but very, very, not nearly at the same level. So we kind of forget about it until Edith keeps bringing it back up, which is exactly how we should feel about the story. Edith knows the key piece of information that we as readers need to understand the story, but we actually also keep forgetting her. On some level, right? Because we get so wrapped up in the reiterations of all these murder mysteries, and then Edith pops up. It's, oh yeah, Edith was also part of the story. So it does a really good job of using all of this surreal nonsense to kind of get you to actually kind of half forget about the character whose main concern is being forgotten.
So when I listen to this every time, even the first time, in my brain, when I'm picturing it, it very much has that sort of Tom Baker's horror error.
Yes.
For me, for the aesthetic. Because when I listen to something, I envision like the aesthetic, different beats of it. And that is the whole aesthetic that falls over this one episode when I listen to it.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely that kind of, there's a lot of Talents of Wang Chiang vibe in this. You're right. Ghost Light's also a huge influence.
And I was thinking almost like a horror of Fang Rock vibe to it also, specifically.
Oh, true, yeah. But I mean, one of the things that is great about this story is that Robert Sherman recognizes that, who's the writer, by the way, I don't know, made that clear. Robert Sherman's the writer for this episode. He knows that that horror, and specifically kind of that Victorian Edwardian horror, is in the DNA of Doctor Who. And so that you don't need to work hard to connect those pieces. And so he can confidently go, okay, you know Doctor Who. On some level, you recognize these things are valid. So I can compress all of what would normally be an entire Doctor Who story into episode one. And so here's all they show up, they move around, they find a weird thing happening, they introduce the cast, something strange happens, all that gets crammed in episode one, and then each episode after that, I can add a new layer onto things. Now it's Doctor Who's Agatha Christie mystery, which, to be fair, had not been done before at this point. It's actually new. Now it's Doctor Who as...
Black Orchard.
Oh, no, you're right. Okay, my apologies. Haven't been done often.
Or, and not explicitly. Better yet, hadn't been done well.
Okay, arguably. I mean, if this is Ghost Light, another type of Ghost Light, y'all argue with another stab at Black Orchard.
Oh, no. I was taking a stab at Black Orchard.
And then it's the, now we can do Doctor Who as surreal metafiction. But again, it would have been really easy to make this into weird time chronostasis, jargony, blah, blah, blah. And that's not what happens. The Doctor is using, this whole time he's using naturalistic language to explain things that are going on.
The other route is more of a fourth and seventh Doctor sort of adventure compared to this. That is more of an eighth Doctor. I'd almost say fifth or eighth Doctor adventure style.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, there's a little bit of fifth and a little bit of 11 looking forward. But it really is distinctive to the eighth Doctor is that he doesn't lean on psychobabble nearly as much. He could have said, you know, the psychic impressions of the people here embedded into the walls and it caused a chrono historicism. No, he just says, the people who died here made the house come alive. He uses very naturalistic language. And that helps to add to the mystery of the Doctor, but also sells the setting a lot better, which is that this is weird. This is a weird horror story.
You also need that language to draw in the listener more because they can't see it. So you have to strike the appropriate balance between awkward language use compared to like inviting language use. Both of them have their strengths and weaknesses for different situations.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, what's interesting here is that, again, for a different writer, it would have been not Charlie's time period per se, but it's close enough. Like, this is basically one generation earlier than Charlie's actual time period. But she's pretty comfortable in this environment. And the Doctor's very comfortable in strangeness. So it would have been easy to kind of split the plot line in those avenues, which is that Charlie's talking to the people and the Doctor's investigating the mystery. And that's not quite what happens. They both do a little of each. And neither is the Doctor's... He approaches Shaughnessy as a problem, right? And you see his approach. He's like, Shaughnessy has a problem I have to solve. Why is he holding a gun to me? And why is he so easy to manipulate? So he keeps kind of going back to that well to try to solve the problem. Charlie is trying to understand why everyone is acting the way they are. And so she's trying to get to the emotional heart of the problem. And they both come up with different information that connects together to make the Doctor realize what's going on. So Charlie's role is just as valid. She's not just talking to people to make friends. She's getting a key piece of the information. And also, like you said, she's the one who can hear Edith, which is another huge piece of this puzzle. So again, the seventh Doctor was always the dynamic of him was always, he's at worst improvising off of a relatively strong plan. And at best is secretly building the whole thing. The eighth Doctor is pretty consistently catching up to the plot, and that's it's a like I said, it's a more Fifth Doctor in that vibe as well. But it's a very different change from the previous, which again, for a generation, you want to have a strong change. But the one thing that I always love about Paul McGann's kind of spin on it is that during all of this, during the deep parts, the Doctor's like, he admits to being scared. But he doesn't sound like he's scared. He sounds like he's having a blast. And that's the Doctor in a nutshell. It's like, Charlie's like, you know, even questions him on it. And he's like, no, I'm scared. But the way he's delivering that line does not sound like he's scared.
And much like the Fifth Doctor, who frequently fail wins, the Eighth Doctor is very similar in that aspect also.
Yep.
Wins very much in the short term, like super short term wins, which goes back to, I would not want to travel with the Fifth, Eighth, or Sixth Doctor.
Yeah, right.
Or the First. That, well.
For sure. It can make your head brained in my rock.
Anything else you want to talk about episode 3?
Nope, let's go on to the finale, because this is where it gets interesting. The Doctor explains that they're still in the TARDIS, but they're stuck in a time loop. He then explains the problem is that they are the Paradox and are trapped. The household finds them and reveals their master is coming to meet them, and they transport Charlie elsewhere despite the Doctor's protests. The Doctor meets Edward Grove, who has taken over the body of Shaughnessy, who serves as a communication vessel, because they can only hire so many actors. Charlie, meanwhile, finds Edith again, and she asks Edith to show herself. Edith does, and Charlie, shocked, realizes Edith was the cook in her family's old estate, having not recognized her earlier because when Edith worked as a scullery maid, she looked different, younger, as it was her first job. She mysteriously explains that she died for Charlie. The Doctor and Edward Grove chat, and the Doctor condemns Edward's horrible treatment of the household. He further questions the point of Grove's existence, but Grove reveals it was enough for him to simply exist, even if it means keeping the others enslaved in the Paradox going. Edith explains to Charlie that the horrible treatment she's had to endure her whole life and how Charlie was always so kind to her, and explains that Grove has filled aspects of her life into the household. When Charlie asks why there's so much death, Edith simply says she's died for Charlie, even though she came back to life. The Doctor and Grove talk more, and Grove reveals the Doctor and Charlie are already giving him life, having arrived and created a Paradox. Edith explains to Charlie that when the news of her death in the R101 crash reached home, Edith was ignored by all as the mood in the house was depressed over Charlie's death, and yet she, Edith, was not allowed to mourn Charlie, her best friend. Not wanting to live without Charlie, she commits suicide in the kitchen the night of Christmas Eve. Doctor tries to convince Grove to commit suicide, saying that he is not really alive, but Grove declares that having tasted existence, he will keep the Paradox going for a single moment, destroying everything inside the loop to keep himself alive. Doctor tries to stop him, volunteering to sacrifice himself and gain advantage of the household's commitments to serve with him under Grove's earlier orders, first telling them to kill him, Grove trying his best to stop him. Edith tries to convince Charlie to commit suicide since Charlie was supposed to have died in the R101 1931, but is still alive here in 1906. Charlie must make a choice, either her life or Edith's. The Doctor, however, managing to overcome Grove, reaches out to Charlie and convince her that to live, and the two of them convince Edith to live, ending the Paradox. Everything returns to normal, and as a final check, the Doctor lands the TARDIS in the moment they arrive just before the Paradox occurred, and when they find Edith, they disguise themselves, telling Shaughnessy that Edith has done fine work as a scullery maid. Charlie tells Edith she's not a nobody, but a good person, and they leave, having resolved and broken the Paradox. And holy shit, this episode. So, on the one hand, we have yet again moved to this is... The whole time, it was both A, a domestic drama, was the actual story we're in, but also B, nope, it was actually a time part. It was time loop the whole time. The first thing we thought was actually true, but now for completely different reasons, which is an amazing rug pull to pull, which is like the big twist is it's secretly the thing you thought it was all along.
I love it. I love it. I love it. That's just not so for good. The reason you thought, which is brilliant.
Yes. But on top of it, we go to the whole point, like the whole everyone forgetting Edith, don't forget Edith, the roles people play. It all kind of comes to head in the conversation in the between Charlie and Edith. And what's interesting about this conversation is that it is not an easy one. Because one thing I kind of glossed over is Edith says, so you're my best friend, then you died. And Charlie has to admit, I didn't even know who you were at first.
But see, that's the crux of it. People don't understand how the smallest kindness can mean the world to people. Like you have no idea what everyone else's lived experiences. Even just a casual smile, a head nod could change someone's life. And this shows you that perfect example of how it does. And sometimes not always for the better.
Right. And that's one thing that's great about Charlie is because, again, in a lesser writer's hands, Charlie would be like, of course, you're my friend. I just didn't recognize you when you were younger. Hey, we're buddies. Charlie's like, I didn't. Another piece is that I've forgotten her name already. The one who makes plum pudding. She is the older version of Edith. So she's actually both versions of Edith in the same household, which is part of the time loop problem because she's missing when everything gets corrected. And because it was her plum pudding that Charlie liked, which is how kind of all this settles up. And there's a great moment where Edith slowly starts to change her voice into that of the cook. So you recognize that? Again, a great thing that only audio can really do well. Because visually it would have been too obvious, and we're changing between these two faces. But it's something you almost don't quite recognize the voice changing until you start hearing those cadences and you start talking about plum pudding. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. Oh, it's the same person. I get it. But yeah, I mean, like I said, in the lesser person, it could have been easy. But Charlie's like, had to admit, like, no, I didn't see you there because I didn't think of you because you were one of the lesser classes. And Charlie learns from that. Charlie recognizes this is a failing on her part. But it's such a gut punch. And then on top of it, the doctor having to have the conversation with Edward Grove of like, you need to die so other people can live. And then Charlie's having the exact same conversation with Edith is so fucking dark. And again, one thing I love about this one is because it's constantly shifting on you. Like this is the thing where an hour ago we were going, look at the silly murder mystery stuff going on. Oh, she committed suicide by choking on her own pudding. Isn't that funny? Now this house has to kill itself so that other people could live.
But it also, then there's an undercurrent of that is about society and how manners are not a representation of being a good person. Because you have Edward Grove, who is being impeccable with his manners, and the doctor would be kind of a brute knocking shit over and everything else, causing more work for the servants. But he's also the active force trying to save them, and Edward Grove is a force trying to enslave them.
Right, and so we get this what really boils down to is conflict between order and chaos, and the doctor clearly taking the side of chaos. And what's on top of all of this, the fact it's happening on Christmas, it does a few things. One, it's a backwards residence, but Doctor Who now having a strong Christmas special theme and Christmas special being a strong thing in Doctor Who.
Are we still on Christmas Eve? Or are you just using Christmas in the general sense of the season?
Yeah, Christmas season, yeah, general sense. Yeah. I mean, that's the actual thing. I mean, because some of the Christmas specials have all taken place Christmas Eve, but my point is like it's around Christmas. That wasn't really a strong Doctor Who trope at the time. It's since become one, so this retroactively feels like very, very New Who in that regard again, so it ages very well. But also, the Edwardian Christmas is kind of this ideal. And one thing this story is doing is that it's taking an ideal, it twists it in one direction, the sci-fi direction, as being weird. But then it ends up actually wrenching hard back towards this ideal that we have is actually really fucking horrible. And we should think about that. And the fact is that you don't realize entirely the strong twist has happened until you're deep in that conversation with Edith and Charlie and going, oh, that's what this story is about. You know, it's not deconstructing Doctor Who time loop. It's deconstructing the ideal of Edwardian Christmas and the Edwardian lifestyle. And they know actually it was really horrible for some of the people who lived through it. And also we see the starts of, you know, again, this is, you know, now we're deep into the Charlie dying is actually a problem thing, but not in a sci-fi sense, in a her choosing to go with the doctor impacted her family, which is, again, something aside from Tegan's aunts, we don't see very often the consequences on the people they leave behind.
I understand that, but at the same time, if Charlie had been aboard the ship, she would have died. If she was aboard the R101, dead.
Right.
Leaving with the doctor. So there would have been the same impact with her death. The only difference is there might not have been a temporal anomaly. Maybe, and that's iffy.
I mean, fair, but also there's the arguments of getting slightly further ahead. If Charlie wasn't inclined towards adventure, she wouldn't be in the R1 to begin with, which then gets into if she had played her Edwardian role, she would not be dead. But if she played her Edwardian role, she would then be playing into the status quo that this episode's trying to refute. So again, there's no easy answers in any of this.
She would have only wished that she was dead.
Right, right. And then there's a whole Charlie spinoff, which goes into exactly that, which I've not listened to, but I've heard is also deeply weird. Mm. Which I love. Also because Charlie's mom is played by Anna Wilkie, which is great.
My question for you then, do you say Merry Christmas or Happy Christmas?
Right now I mix them. Okay. I usually say Merry Christmas. That's what's usually we say in America.
America! Fuck America. Yeah.
And so I started moving to Happy Christmas here, but apparently it is kind of 50-50 even here. So
interesting. Any other thoughts about this weird but yet great episode?
Honestly, all I have to say, I mean, I've said a lot of stuff, but I mean, it really comes down to I do continue to reiterate this is a really good representative sample of the first 4 or 5 years, the Charlie era, if you will, of the Eighth Doctor. Even though Paul McGann is not really the center of it, the nice thing about this is that we don't entirely know that at the first. So it's and because of the way it's structured, there's a lot of Doctor and Charlie time together. And so you get a really strong sense of their relationship and dynamic in this story. So it's one of my favorites. When I'm picking up random stories to listen to from Sarah, this is usually pretty high on the list. But also, I mean, this is just one of many components, right? Like, this is also an era that is extremely experimental. There's an entire story about the Doctor and how he accidentally ends up in Orson Welles's War of the Worlds broadcast and how that plays out. Another riff on how audio can work. And there are some just bad stories. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's one set in America which is just fucking awful on a wide variety of levels. And the British American accents are really the least of the problems of that story. It's also just deeply, deeply problematic. So it's not perfect. But I also like the story because this is one of the ones you can look at and go, man, they could take this script, make a few minor changes, and they could film it today. It would fit really well. I mean, I would love to see Shooty in this story, right? It'd be great.
Yeah. Excellent.
How about you?
You've covered a lot of it in detail that I would have said, which is one of my joys of doing this, is that we think somewhat similarly on a lot of, but not completely, which makes it fun. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when it comes to wrap up, you so succinctly put them that I get to just say, I concur, Eddie.
Well done, sir.
Good job, Bullsport.
Well done. So that's it. So we're gonna do Neverland now, right? That's coming up.
So in the end, as you probably have realized, I like to whiffle waffle between things because I have so many different ideas, and I went in a totally different direction. And in fact, the next one of these we're gonna do, and this is gonna be our last audio adventure for a while. Actually, to touch on some of the ideas, this will be our last audio adventure for a while. Eventually, we'll do a wrap-up, and we'll be moving out of Who in about 4-ish episodes into new territory.
Yes.
There, as I am unsure of when we're releasing something, there may be a special in there somewhere.
Yes.
Special, just not the special.
So by the time I listen to this, you probably will have already heard our special, which is Mike Pondsmith talking ostensibly about the Transformers movie. Which is our short version, the long version, which is over an hour longer. You can only get through Chris's Patreon, so pledge for that. But yes, after this, we're going to do a wrap-up, and then we decided that since it was relevant, we're going to pull the power – we also referenced it. We're going to pull the Power of the Doctor out, which is our very first Patreon exclusive episode.
Wow.
Cut that into two separate episodes because it was very long. And so we're going to have two episodes of us talking about – the anniversary special wasn't actually an anniversary special, and in some ways it's a better anniversary special than the anniversary specials we actually got.
And that has our hot takes, because we talked about it when it came out.
Yeah,
our thought about and like debated takes between each other later, but like we just watched it and we talk about it.
Yeah, but, and that was before all of the 14 and 15 stuff, so it was Jesus. Fresh in our minds.
And before all that, though, the next one of these is going to be the Silver Turk, which I jump further ahead in Big Finish's timeline. And there's no Charlie. I'm not going to tell you who the companion is unless you go and listen to
it. It's actually before Charlie.
What's that?
It was released later, but it was actually before Charlie, technically speaking.
It's all very timey-wimey.
Timey-wimey.
So I'm pretty excited about that. Eddie, if people are looking to find you online, to buy your swag, to support you in some small way for the time that you give them to come onto this podcast late in the afternoon in the wee hours of the morning for me, though, where could they do that?
Just don't find me. I'm not worth it. No. You can find my stuff at Pugsteady, PUGSTEADY. That's my website. As you can find me on social media. I have a Patreon if you want to get stories about post-apocalyptic dogs doing weird stuff. Right now I'm in the process of writing my dogs, but Sherlock Holmes and Jeeves and Wooster story. So that kind of nonsense. I'm here for you. Give me money.
Well, all right. You said it now. So which species of dog is Birdie?
He is an Afghan.
Okay.
I was our Afghan.
All right.
And
Wooster is a cat. Wooster one day.
Yeah. Wooster is a cat. So there you go. But yeah, otherwise, really the best place to chat with me and both of us is the Darker Hue Discord, because we're always hanging up there. There's a speechless and a genreless channel there. Ask us questions. We'll probably answer. Maybe with a meme, but we'll answer.
If you're looking for me, you can, of course, go to the Dark Hue Studios website. You can pick up Haunted West. You could go to Chaosium and pick up Harlem Balancing Edition. If you want to really support me, you could come to the Patreon, where I drop two or three things a month of what I think are high quality, but yet varying worth in your campaign, depending on what you're running or what random history tidbit I feel like writing about that month. I keep thinking I'm going to go back and pick up my talk about the Black Panthers from World War II, because I gave everyone, and by gave, I mean they paid me for it, the first one of a series talking about the Black Panthers. And this was like the build-up piece, and it was like 2,000 words. And I'm thinking about doing the next one. Eventually, I want to turn it into a mechanical piece at the end. So it's like history, mechanical bit.
Nice. Very cool.
My scheduling and time is very narrow and fleeting.
Do it when you can. But until then, next time, come listen to us talk about the Silver Turk.